Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Soul Train, the Chicago Bulls' three-peats, Black Silent Films, Fashion Fair Cosmetics. These are just a handful of Chicago's contributions to the world, spearheaded by members of the Black community. And this rich history is laid out in immaculate detail in a new book, We Are the Culture, Black Chicago's Influence on Everything, explains how our city has led pop culture in America for decades and gives insight into the ways culture shapes our lives. I sat down with journalist, pop culture commentator, and native Chicagoan Ariane Nettles to talk about her debut book. We start the conversation with some Chicago culture she was surprised to find 900 miles from her Inglewood childhood home. Here's Ariane.
I saw Kanye West through the Wire video, mm-hmm. and this was 2003, so this was really early. This was not like the Kanye that, you know, we know today.
This is the old Kanye.
This is the old Kanye. But if you remember that video, it had shots throughout the city. So it had shots of the Harolds on 103rd and mm-hmm. Halsted, which is actually near my house now, where I live. There were shots of people footworking at the Halsted Mall. Mm-hmm. And I had actually just joined that dance team. We had just started a chapter of it at FAMU. And so I'm like, oh, wait, no, look, you know. And so we're trying to kind of like break through and kind of like show Chicago culture down here in Florida.
Yeah.
And I look up and it's on the TV. And so all of those kind of like homesick nerves just kind of flew away. And it felt like home.
Yeah, I love that story so much. It's in the section of your book that's titled And You Say Shy City.
Yeah.
Of course, it's a reference to the beginning of that 2007 Kanye song, Homecoming, that we just heard. It's where you write about footworking, but you also write about house music in that mm-hmm. section, Chicago drill. I want to hear more about your overall choice, Ariane, to divide this book into its 11 parts.
Yeah, yeah. It was actually pretty tough because I knew that I wanted to hit big parts of culture, right? So you know that you got to have music. You got to have something about some kind of food, some kind of entertainment, mm-hmm. TV and film in some way, some kind of sports, and art. But how that breaks down can be really complicated.
Yeah.
And how much of it to do, that was just a really hard decision because frankly, it can't fit in one book. Mm-hmm. So I tried to kind of prioritize things that I knew that I had something to say and things that I knew I could draw strong correlations myself.
Right, right. It seems to me, though, when reading the book, that We Are the Culture should have its own soundtrack. Because you open several chapters and you list the song that you were listening to while writing it, right? I Am Changing by Jennifer Hudson, for instance.
Yeah.
That kicks off the part about Chicago and Black hair products. And Go by Common, which is one of my favorites. That's at the top of the Chicago sports chapters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you blasted this song when you wrote the part about Chicago's urban radio music scene. So that's obviously Rufus and Chaka Khan's Sweet Thing. But how did this and other songs impact your thought process and your productivity?
Yeah, so part of it was that I was writing most of this book late at night. So I would start writing around like 9 p.m. at night. And I kind of needed some encouragement to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
I do write to music. I know some people can't write to music.
I can't do it.
But I can. It doesn't affect me. I can be singing and I'm totally
Wow.
Not thinking of it, you know.
Even the fact that you write at night, I'm like, wow, how? Yeah. I feel like I do my best writing in the daytime.
Yeah.
At night, I'm just like, I'm ready to
lock it up. I think it was because, you know, it was the during the day, I'm trying to work. I have so many distractions. I don't have like a solid block of time. Mm-hmm. Like I have to start and then stop. And then I have to do class and then I have to pick up my son. And then I have all these things. But at nighttime, there are no distractions, right?
Yeah.
Like it's the day is finally over and I really need it's like big blocks of time to kind of concentrate on a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I needed music to kind of like really push me through, to kind of like amp me up. So it would be literally like 1 o'clock in the morning and I'm listening to Chief Keef. I'm like super pumped because it's like getting me through.
Right. And we got some good content out of it for sure. The early chapters in the book, they focus on the creation of the Chicago Defender newspaper mm-hmm. and the Conservator. And you tie the stories, of course, of leading Black journalists of the time, like Ida B. Wells, Ferdinand Barnett, Robert Singstack Abbott. In your research, what are some of the things that you learned about their lives that maybe surprised you, their lives and their careers?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, today we are taught, you know, that our lives have to be so much separate from our careers as journalists, right? And I think that kind of looking back at those times, it's really a reminder of how much we can't do that, right? Like what goes on in the world, we are integrated into everything, mm-hmm. you know? And so many of the choices that they made to become journalists or anyways, mm-hmm. or to do those things were because of what was happening, right?
Out of necessity.
Out of necessity, right? And so as storytellers, they did those things, quite frankly, because of the reason that, you know, there were issues happening and they wanted to expose things or they wanted to help people or they wanted to give people information or they wanted to help people become more self-reliant. So there's like all these different reasons, but it was all of those reasons were integrated into the world around them. And mm-hmm. so I think just that reminder that as journalists, we are a part of communities. We are a part of our world. And so we are not so separate that we are just like doing this stuff for ourselves.
It lends to that objectivity conversation that we've been having, especially in recent years.
Yeah.
Right. Tell us the story then of Negro Digest and how that magazine sort of came about. I know this was before the birth of publications we know from Chicago, like Ebony and Jet, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And this was a publication that I thought I had really known about. And I think, you know, a lot of people probably have maybe heard the name, but I think my timing was a bit off. I had previously thought that Negro Digest came along a little bit later, but Negro Digest was actually John Johnson's first publication.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you think about Reader's Digest, right?
Yeah.
And especially at this time, it was very white, right? Throughout the years, they started incorporating some Black writers. But for the most part, there was not the Black perspective that John Johnson wanted to create. So he kind of like, you know, used his mother's furniture on credit and went and started this magazine. And he really was quite innovative in his approach to how he did it, you know. So first of all, he, you know, was really good at marketing it. He would have friends and people he knew go around to newsstands and say stuff like, hey, do you carry Negro Digest, you know. So the newsstands are like, well, I don't know. I guess we should be.
Getting the word out there.
Exactly. And he had a really interesting column called If I Were a Negro, where famous white people would actually write columns. So Eleanor Roosevelt wrote a column where she talked about a lot of stuff and she talked about the war. And so it kind of really became quite popular.
Mm-hmm.
later on, as the word Negro fell out of favor, and, you know, as Black people, we turn towards the word Black, and we really kind of embrace Black power.
Yeah.
It kind of turned into a little bit more of a literary magazine later on called Black World. But by that point, we had Ebony and Jet, and so it just didn't, you know, stay around as long.
Yeah.
But originally, it was the first one, and it was kind of like the first thing that started.
Yeah. I learned about Negro Digest through your book. Yeah, so that was great. There's so much for readers to learn, and We Are the Culture. You write also, you know, the story of the Great Migration, which we've all heard, but there are details that, again, I didn't know until reading this book. We also learned stories about you and your bloodline from Chicago and Mississippi. So yeah. To me, Ariane, this felt like part memoir, this book, but I think I hear you say that this isn't a memoir.
I wouldn't call it a memoir.
Why not?
I think because the way I see memoirs, and I could be wrong, you know, I just, the way I see it is that usually if you have a memoir, you're kind of telling this unique story. And I really use essays at the start of these sections to kind of, I guess, relate to people.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want so many people to read them and kind of say, either I experienced that same thing, or I know people who experienced that same thing. So it's really kind of was more of a mode of connection.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to say like, oh, I did this thing that was different, because I specifically tried to only talk about things that I felt were, of course, there are no universal experiences, but pretty common experiences growing up here in Chicago, especially as a Black person.
WBEZ is supported by Chicago Humanities, presenting live events with historians Doris Kearns Goodwin and John Meacham, comedian Reggie Watts and filmmaker Miranda July, and artists Hebrew Brantley and Amanda Williams in conversation, plus MSNBC chief correspondent Ali Velshi on small yet powerful acts of courage throughout history. Tickets for these events and more conversations on arts, culture, and current affairs at chicagohumanities.org.
Let's skip now to a chapter that you call The First Taste of Beauty.
Fashion Fair Cosmetics, one of the first major cosmetics companies in the U.S. targeting people of color. The Chicago-based company launched in 1973, made products created just for Black and brown skin. In its heyday, the products were used by celebrities, including supermodel Pat Cleveland, actress Diane Carroll, and legendary Aretha Franklin.
So that's one of several news reports. This was back in 2021. When the iconic brand Fashion Fair, which started right here in Chicago, was mm-hmm. about to make that big comeback, Ariane.
Yeah.
I love how you tell the story. Speaking of those essays, you tell the story of how your mother sort of introduced you to their lipsticks.
Yeah.
Colors that you're still wearing to this day.
Exactly. She always, you know, would talk about like, oh, you know, got to have a signature red, right? I always remember like my mom, my godmom, right? Like everyone having like a little Fashion Fair compact or a little Fashion Fair lipstick.
Yeah.
And so it's just such an iconic logo that it took me a while to grow up and to like really realize like not just that it was iconic, but like that necessity of it, you know?
Yeah.
Just realizing that before we had Fashion Fair, that there were literally models creating and mixing their own foundation, like
just to try to get a match.
Yeah. Like, you know, mixing up some eyeshadow in some foundation and kind of blending it and becoming artists.
Yes.
Just so that you can get a match before you go on the runway.
Which
right?
is wild. So wild. This book is about Chicago's stamp on everything. And I love that you don't hesitate in some parts to give credit where it's due to other American cities, right? You're also very clear in the introduction of the book, too. You say, you know, this 200 plus pages, like it's not a full anthology of Black Chicago. Yeah. I would need days. Mm-hmm. I would need several books for that. Mm-hmm. Why was it important to put that disclaimer out there and early?
Yeah, because, well, for one, we're very proud here in Chicago, and I could just hear now people saying, let me tell you what you missed out on. Let me tell you what you left out, right? So I knew specifically, you know, as I'm making some of these like cuts and saying, oh, I can't really get into that. If I get into this, then the whole book is going to be about this. Like, for example, my first outline had so much music. It was so music heavy mm-hmm. that there really wouldn't be space to dive into
for the other
stories. Mm-hmm. But, you know, looking at gospel music, for example, and like its origins, like of modern gospel mm-hmm. in Chicago, and Thomas Dorsey and Mahalia Jackson, and a lot of those stories so interesting.
But you had to leave some of it out.
I got
to
make decisions, right? You know, so it's like, okay, I got blues. Do I do blues and jazz? Or do I just try to talk about jazz a little bit when I'm also talking about the Chicago Renaissance, right? Mm-hmm. There's just so much stuff. I just hope more people write more books so we can have more perspectives.
Or maybe you write part two. Who knows? You dedicate the book to Chicago. You say this is a love letter to Chicago. You dedicate it to your grandmothers. I love you call them your sugar and your spice.
Yes.
Very cute. And your son, Jackson.
Yeah.
Who is also now being raised in that same bloodline we talked mm-hmm. about, right? When he's much older, what impression do you believe Chicago's culture will have left on him?
Yeah, I think a lot about like this current generation and their future. Mm-hmm. And I'm just really proud of them. Like, I think not just about like my son, but like about my friends' sons and daughters and, you know, non-binary kids and all the kids in this new generation, right? Yeah. And I am so impressed by them. Like, they are literally 6 and 7 going to the MCA and looking at the Faith Ringgold, you know, rest in peace exhibit. Like, they are so in tune.
They are the future.
And I think that they know that, like, this is their city. I want them to know this is their city, right? And I want them to know that they come from, like, this long line of all this greatness so mm-hmm. that they can feel comfortable going after what they want.
Yeah.
You know, like, every generation is supposed to be freer. You know, like, I think about, like, my grandma, like, yes, she came up here and, like, she had, you know, my grandma and my grandpa had, like, a tavern and a record label, but, like, my grandma also worked as a maid, right?
Yeah.
She also did a lot of labor. She also picked cotton. And so she did all that stuff for me to be able to be a professor, to be an author, to be all these things. And so every single generation, like, she did that for my mom to be a teacher, and then my mom worked
And now
hard.
You're doing this for your son.
Exactly.
And so forth. That's
exactly.
incredible. We'll leave it there. That's journalist and pop culture commentator Arianne Nettles. Her new book, We Are the Culture, Black Chicago's Influence on Everything, is in stores now. Thank you so much, Arianne, and congrats again.
Thank you, Sasha.
Let's go out now on one more song that Arianne listened to while writing this book. Here's Very Black by Jamila Woods featuring No Name.
Hey.
Serving and protecting is stealing babies' lives.
I'm very black, 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 it's in me.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by me. It was edited by Maha Ahmed and mixed by Brenda Ruiz. Now, if there's a topic that you'd like us to cover here on Reset, email us at reset@wbez.org or leave us a voicemail at 888-915-9945. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll talk again tomorrow.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.